Look at the distortion in the air in front of you. See it fold and ripple, the way the light glistens off something that should not be there? Can you catch a glimpse of what is on the other side? It's called a wind door, and will take you to places both like and unlike our world. This one will take you to the 10 worlds of New Century, as written by Alex Shaw. Come with us on a journey through the wind door. Welcome back, listeners, to Through the Wind Door, a New Century Multiverse podcast. I am joined here by Toby.
Hello there.
And I'm Greg, and we're going to continue our revisit of the story Let Them Go, the quote-unquote beginning of Phase 1 of the New Century Multiverse. I hope you've already listened to Chapters 1 through 5. And if not, you should probably get on that. Otherwise, you'll be completely lost as we start to get into it. But we are now going to discuss chapters 6 through 9 of Let Them Go. As before, we're going to start off with a brief synopsis of what happens in those chapters. Following on what happened previously in chapter 5, where an unusual and strangely alien creature attacked Amanda, people are responding immediately to what happened, trying to make sure that they're safe and bring some sort of logic to what in the world just went on there. They have to bandage Amanda's wound and figure out whatever it is they need to do in order to protect themselves, over the course of which we get some more alone time between Amanda and Rafe as we learn more about their relationship and more about Rafe as a character, as Amanda is feeling particularly emotional and is looking for some emotional vulnerability from him as well, which he promptly gives because that's just how he rolls. We like Rafe.
We really like Rafe.
Which makes things particularly difficult as things go on. Because after...
Right, nothing bad happens in these chapters and you can't convince me otherwise.
Right, it's a gothic horror. Clearly nothing bad ever happens.
They're all sunshine and rainbows, gothic horrors.
But anyway, after Amanda is immediately taken care of, Rafe promptly takes charge of the situation, and goodness knows we want him to take charge of the situation, because everything he does as he lays out the situation, saying, look, something's attacked my wife, we don't know what it is, we can make some suppositions as to what is going on here, but this is still the modern era. My wife has been wounded, and she may even be getting sick as a result of the bite, because we know that's a thing that can happen. And we don't want to make ourselves vulnerable to this thing by trying to go out there and get to a doctor, especially at this time of night, without being attacked, especially when we only have one gun and one person that's explicitly trained in its use. Using the best logic and the best idea that I have at my disposal, I'm just going to go out there, I'm going to kill this person, and then we can proceed with making sure that the rest of us are safe, making sure that my wife is safe, and everything should be fine, because I have, not everything should be fine, but this is the best idea I can come up with, and thank goodness he has a good head on his shoulders, because Dawson keeps trying to interject, but we keep seeing that, well, first of all, he's not really trained for this kind of situation, whereas Rafe is a military man and is able to
keep calm under pressure.
Well, he very literally just talked with Amanda a second ago about this is the kind of thing that soldiers have to do, and but he is also acting from an emotional place, from an empathetic place. There are things that might happen that might be safer and make sense from a logical standpoint, but the thing that matters most to him is making sure that Amanda survives, and that's why he sets off on the course he does.
This is very much a story where I think, especially owing to the fact that Alex has watched one too many horror films where characters make ludicrous leaps in logic and everyone's at jumping to conclusions and making things that seem ill-prepared. I think this scene is very much written from the perspective of wanting to make sure that even Dawson, who is the sort of the idiot in the room, let's not mince words, even he is trying to kind of offer some ideas. And I would say that they're not the most illogical or ill-founded. It's just that he is motivated by a place of fear and wanting to save his own skin, whereas I think Rafe has the experience to know when a unsound battle strategy, for lack of a better phrase, has been, like, to be able to tell the difference between that will get us killed or that won't see us through. And this one isn't a surefire route to success, but given the odds that we have just surmised in this room, this is the best way forward.
It isn't necessarily simply about saving Amanda, although that is the primary thing in his concern. As a soldier, he is doing what he thinks is best for the survival of everybody here. He is naturally situated towards thinking of the safety of everybody rather than Dawson, who is thinking about his own safety. As you said, Dawson is selfish and Rafe is not. Unfortunately, as things proceed, even with a good head on his shoulders and military training, he is not up to the task of taking down the monster and is unfortunately brought low by the end of Chapter 7. The Chapter 7 is titled A Course of Action, and unfortunately that course of action, while presented correctly and what people feel like should lead to success, unfortunately leads to the downfall of one of the strongest characters.
Up to this point, we've been succinctly shown why Rafe is the person you want in a time of crisis, which means that for the purposes of ratcheting up the tension, he is the first one to go. He has to be the first one you take off the table so that you think, okay, the one person we definitely need around to give us the best chances, and he's gone.
Yeah. It sets us off as we mean to go on by showing, and this is one of the things I wanted to eventually bring up, but how you can make reasoned decisions and you can do everything right and still lose. There's a quote that people like to bring up. It's specifically from Star Trek The Next Generation, where Captain Picard is explaining to Data, the android, It is always possible to do everything right and lose, and that's life. That happens, and you have to find a way to go on with that.
It's very much like the Kobayashi Maru test, I think it's called. Yeah, where the point of that test is to show that sometimes there really is a no-win scenario, despite what some certain characters in that universe might say.
In that particular test, the important thing is to find out how you move on from tragedy, how you deal with it, what are the kind of choices that you have to make, because you have to make choices that are the best for everybody, even in the bleakest of situations. But now we have been denied the person that is able to think the coolest under pressure, and the things only further unspool now that Dawson is made only more afraid. And of course, obviously, he thinks the story is now continually all about him, because obviously, as the only man present, then, you know, he's the one that should make decisions for whatever is going on. But he can't even get there at this point because he is scared and demanding that the grief-stricken Amanda be taken away by Rebecca, because he can't think with all this caterwauling, damn it, and all that sort of thing.
Sound you heard a moment ago, by the way, dear listeners, was my head slamming against the table. So please carry on.
And it is in chapter 8 where we finally get the name of the monster, because up till this point, we're like, oh, it's just an insane person from an insane asylum. But this is a monster story on some level. And Amanda being the most, the one that has read the most and is most in tune with the ideas of the arcane or the supernatural or the fairy, the kind of stuff that the poem was hinting at the very beginning of the book, she takes something out of all those stories that she's heard or read and names it. And it's not, the name Barghest is not the word that they choose to use for this monster going forward, because spoilers, it's going to show up again. But
really? Nah.
I feel like on some level it's also very appropriate, because while she brings up the name of the Wendigo, which is very impressive for her to have heard, that's a name that comes from the other side of the ocean. That's something that comes from the Americas, and
It would be an obscure piece of knowledge even in America. So for her to have that knowledge to hand is very impressive, as you say.
Yeah, no, she uses a term that is more native to this side of the world. And even as Rebecca points out, they're like, look, this thing isn't actually a dog. And he's like, well, maybe they don't look like a dog. But as things progress, it certainly seems more and more like they act less like a zombie, but more like a werewolf.
All around the world, we've given names to these monsters. There are vampires in the graveyards of Budapest, Vitalas in the charnel grounds of India, Al-Ghul haunt the Arabian Peninsula, and the Algonquin tribes of the Americas speak of the Wendigo coming in the depths of winter. But this beast at her threshold has been spoken of in England by another name.
Amanda pulled herself half upright and spoke as though captive of a dream.
The black dog who foretells death in the family.
It definitely wasn't a dog,
said Rebecca, in a manner she hoped was soothing.
Maybe not on the outside. But I name him Barghest for everything he brings and everything he has taken from us and everything he will take.
Yeah. So, you know, there's definitely some canine aspects to its behavior. And Amanda is very keyed into that, you know, whether it's because of her imagination or just because, as things continue to progress in this chapter, there is ongoing issues as Rebecca and Amanda talk, and things get wild between the two of them.
Before we move on, I thought I'd just quickly interject to say that while Wendigo is what these creatures are referred to most of the time in New Century, just because of the perspective that we often inhabit, they are actually still referred to as Barghest in later stories. The point of this isn't necessarily that, it's that, as Amanda points out, these creatures have many names. They will be the Al-Ghuls, they'll be vampires, this ancient beast that people will associate with ancient myths attuned to their area. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt with that. Well, actually,
no, you're absolutely right that the word Barghest will pop back up, and it's actually there's often a conversations that will occur in future. Honestly, anytime that the name comes up, we'll generally know what they're responding to, except as things continue on and we discover, as the saying goes, that there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in your philosophy, because the Wendigo is the big, unknowable, unnatural monster in New Century. It is not the only one.
No, it is not. But I do like something that occurred to me while you were talking, is that the fact that it's Amanda who, and clearly she's not the only one, but in this story, in Let Them Go, the fact that it's her, the storyteller, the creative thinker, who finds some way of wrapping her head around it by associating it with these imagined creatures or these sort of folklores, to me is very reminiscent to Stranger Things, and how a lot of the creatures are kind of just seen as creatures by most of the cast, but it's the kids who play D&D who actually give the official labels to say, this is the Demigorgon, this is the Mind Flayer, and that's only their word for it, but mm-hmm. it's as good as gospel for the series and for the fans. So the fact that Amanda has that, I think, is a similar moment of, these things aren't going to walk up to us and introduce themselves, so we have to come up with something we can use to name it.
Well, naming something is a way to gain power over it. And that's in this particular case, giving it a name that isn't just any name, but is something that has a resonance with someone on any level as being, oh yeah, I've heard of that thing before. Through most of Chapter 6, the very first thing that they were trying to, like, who is this dude? Why did he act the way they did? They tried to use logic and the trappings of the modern world to explain it, because that's what you do. When you encounter something that you don't understand, you very often try to go to what's familiar in order to feel like you're more in control of the situation. And now that they're feeling less in control of the situation and more like they have no idea what this thing actually is, they're having to go back into deeper lore. The naming of the monster is also meant to be an indicator that this is something that you can't just deal with the way you would with a belligerent drunken man, or even, say, an armed mugger. This is alien, this is supernatural, and so therefore anything that we do has to be with that in mind. Therefore, she names it Barghast, as she says.
Mm-hmm.
One wonders if it's just her imagination or just the laudanum that she's taking that has triggered some of this in her, because unfortunately the two of them end up getting into a fight that has absolutely nothing to do with the traumatic events that just happened. And Dawson, being Dawson, bursts in, blundering around, and being like, stop behaving like a weak woman and be quiet so that I can think, because I'm the only one that can think in this situation. Yarl, yarl, yarl. But now, as he is attempting to, I'm sorry, yes, every time we get into these weird asides, it's just like we go to the same place in our heads and just want to throw a book at the wall or something like that.
If we didn't have a duty to be specific, I would just, anytime we come back to Dawson, I would just say, Dawson, Dawson's.
Yes, Dawson's Dawsoning all over the place again.
Oh, it's all over the bed.
As he is trying to impose his will on the situation, we see some of the results of the earlier attack as Amanda just goes off and bites the dude, just like full on, and nobody is expecting this. Nobody knows how to respond to it, and the way Dawson just sort of tumbles off and tries to put space, and in the meantime, Amanda's just sitting up there in bed going like, oh, did something just happen?
He pinned her struggling form and glugged a spoonful out, attempting to shovel it into her gasping mouth. It spilled across the pillows and he shifted his weight to allow her slightly more freedom of movement.
Sit up, girl!
Amanda's head came up and she sank her teeth into his cheek. Immediately there was more blood and screaming as Dawson lurched backwards and away from her. The look in Amanda's eyes, almost as though she were amused, magnified Rebecca and Cleo's concern. But there was something new there for the two of them now. Something that had crept in unacknowledged over the course of the evening. It was horror.
What's going on here? I'm in sort of in a dreamlike state, but that only seems to make things worse. She committed a violent act, not necessarily out of self-defense, but because of something else that's going on there. And Cleo and Rebecca end up looking at each other, being like, this is continuing to be more than we know how to deal with. Let's just lock her in for now as we try and figure out how to deal with this new situation.
There's a turn of phrase in this chapter and in this moment where something which had crept in, which they hadn't realized up until this moment, which was horror. And I think that's very much what is alarming to Amanda and Rebecca, who have a lot of things that they are concerned with right now. But it is this disconnection between the person they know to be Amanda, and her actions just now and her lack of connection with those actions. It's all a sense of horrific dread.
Yeah, no, they don't know what just happened. They don't know if it's the laudanum, but it's just one more detail that makes the situation more difficult to deal with, particularly as they have to then choose to lock Amanda in, perhaps to protect themselves, but also potentially to protect her from Dawson, because Dawson is downstairs Dawsoning, as we say, and they have to bring him back and placate him in order to figure out how they're going to proceed from here. And at least some of that is then followed up with in the final episode we're going to be discussing today, where we finally get some proper conversation and downtime between Rebecca and Cleo, and get a little bit of backstory in terms of how people felt about the various family events that led up to this point, including the death of Timothy, the death of Matthew, and of course making reference to the death of Rebecca and Amanda's mother, Jane, and the things that resulted from that. There's a lot of attempt at emotional healing there, I think, as well as Cleo attempting to show Rebecca that she doesn't blame Rebecca for not being present and for having a hard time dealing with her own pain and responsibilities and everything like that. At the end of the day, these three women, all they have left is each other. And Cleo is leading the way in saying, look, we're going to look out for each other. I'm not going to do what Charles wanted for us. And as soon as Dawson is gone and I have the properties are officially in my hand, we're going to set things up so that we can continue to take care of each other and forge our own path. Because at least, especially in Cleo's case, she has been feeling so alone for a very long time. She is being a little bit selfish here herself, but not in a reprehensible way. She's saying, look, I would have property and money, but all I really want is to find some form of life again and not be alone in this dying house, which, just like it has ghosts for Rebecca, it has ghosts for Cleo as well. And just when it feels like we've come back from the edge,
there's some hope again.
Yeah, Alex has breathed some life back into the story. All of a sudden, we're reminded, oh, right, there's a monster here. And as they are attempting to try and figure out how to act next, Cleo takes charge and unexpectedly manages to stride out into the open, pick up the fallen shotgun, and lay low the, as she refers to it, Cavendish, because there's only one monster at this point, and she shoots him down like some sort of unexpected crone badass, and it's brilliant.
It's a fantastic moment. It's one of the most cathartic scenes in the entire thing, and it's just that sort of transition from the shock of seeing the Barghast Cavendish at the window when they were having tea, and the shock of it causes, I think, Rebecca to drop the teacup. And then when Rebecca's so concerned with thinking about what to do next that she doesn't even notice that Cleo stole out there, and you're so filled with dread and concern, and Aunt Cleo just picks up the shotgun, and it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
But lest we forget, this is still a horror story, so we suddenly discover that there are in fact two more Barghasts who attack jointly on the returning figure of Cleo, and the only thing she can do left, now that she has done her best to protect the family, is to fling the only remaining weapon, or rather the most powerful weapon, at Rebecca, who is watching in the door before Dawson slams it shut. So that's the synopsis of events, and it feels like everything happens not necessarily very quickly, but like after chapter 6, each chapter proceeds in making everything worse on a certain level. Because mm-hmm. while there is that great moment at the end of Chapter 9 where Cleo has this badass moment and we feel like everything should be right again, we suddenly, this is where the story flips the script and be like, oh no, there's still problems to be had, and worst of all, it doesn't talk about this until we get into, again, later chapters, which we'll get into in a future episode. The one thing that is made clear at this point is that now Rebecca only has Dawson to fall back on. And that puts us in a very precarious place, and it's something that Rebecca will have to deal with going on into the rest of the story. But we're talking about these chapters for now, so...
Yes, and the way that the final chapter ends with that sort of victory and that victory being short-lived really does feel as if the threat has the nature of a Hydra, where she quite literally cut off one head by using the shotgun to blow its head off, but then two more took its place. And
wow, yeah. That's a great metaphor. I like that. I hadn't, we were already talking about certain mythological creatures. Let's have one describe another at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that we're talking about how each chapter becomes this sort of progression from bad to worse to even worse to, oh my God, could this get any worse? Oh yes, Dawson's still around. But I think it's how the first of these chapters we're looking at today has this great piece of writing where it talks about how when they come in after the initial attack where Amanda is bitten, for a brief moment it feels as if they were at play, or there was just a sort of alarming incident that they'll talk about later. And at one point Dawson's talking about, oh, this will be an exciting anecdote for the Gentleman's Club, which of course he would. But
yeah,
it's really, I think that what's happening here, apart from just very succinct and laser-focused piece of pacing in this nice, tight story, is also, I think, an anecdote for everything is systematically breaking down. And I think that it's what the prologue establishes, where you see someone else succumb to one of these Barghast, and with the Egyptian rabies, is that you can tell that this is happening all over the world and there's a wide scale to it. But because the story is this intimate, small scale story about five people in one place with a handful of these creatures, but because this story acts as the starting point for this whole series, it kind of has to convey the breakdown of everything, which I think is covered in a bit more extensive detail in a later story, The Cartographer's Handbook. Even so, this does act as a kind of representation of what's happening on a wider scale. So the escalation from bad to worse in Ravenwood is meant to be reflective of how that is also happening on the world stage. And so Dawson is kind of reflective of not just himself, but a whole system that's been put in place. And as more pressure is added onto him, he's starting to snap and break and show his wild side. And I think that's very emblematic of how people do act in this sort of, in these circumstances.
Future editor Greg here. This podcast was recorded close to 2 months ago, and we were focused on talking about the story at hand rather than current events. If you're a fan of Alex, then you already know that all of his stories are bluntly political, so let me be the same. When listening to Toby's description of Dawson, it made me draw some parallels from the ongoing media coverage of certain government responses to coronavirus. And I'm not saying that Dawson is acting like Trump and Boris Johnson. I'm saying Dawson is Trump and Boris Johnson.
Yeah, I think that is very much what I feel when I revisit these chapters, is that even though things feel like they're happening very quickly, they also feel like they're progressing at exactly the most natural rate.
One of the parts that I love the most is Chapter 9 is literally titled A Quiet Moment, and it's meant to be indicative of look, we've had a bunch of bad things happen in succession. We need to have something to try and bring back stability here. And that's definitely the way the story begins, and that it ends the way it does, with success but also tragedy, as our characters slowly get whittled down to the power of this supernatural force. It flips the script a little bit. The title of the chapter tells us to expect one thing. It gives us that, but it also gives us something we didn't expect and is a way of keeping things on their toes. If there's one thing I really like is when some people choose to not divide things into parts the way that Alex likes to, or chooses not to title their chapters or whatever. But I feel like that's a form of storytelling that very much sets a tone for everything else that's going on. And so therefore, when it's present, I like to introspect on what meaning or meanings those titles have. So having re-listened to and reread these chapters, been thinking a lot about the significance of the chapter titles as well, and how they reflect on the story that's being told. That then makes me think about the title of chapters 6 and 7 are actually relatively straightforward. In some ways, they're like, I forget the term, but like when you're writing a paper, you're saying, okay, so we have a beginning, middle, and end here. The beginning is where I tell you what I'm about to tell you. The middle is where I tell you what I'm telling you. And the end is where I remind you of what I told you. Here, yeah. The chapter 6 and chapter 7 very much inhabit that. This is the beginning of a paper here. Chapter 6 is all going to be all about figuring out what just happened. Chapter 7 is going to be all about, okay, this is what we're going to do based on the information we have. And then Chapter 8 sort of starts to become a little bit more fuzzy in that regard, because they called it Afterlife. And that one you sort of have to unpack a little bit more. Okay, so we can look at it as Afterlife because Rafe has just died, so after his life to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. But as we go upstairs to the conversation between Rebecca and Amanda, and they're talking about the supernatural and all that, the way things proceed there, there is also, I mean, this is just me. You can tell me more about how you feel about it, but there is one of the things I wanted to get into with this particular episode is the fact that we are reviewing the story, but both of us have had the additional context that we have been listening to the audio dramas as opposed to just reading the book. And the audio dramas have a whole lot of extra context in there. The musical choices that Alex used to set the scene, or what noises he chooses to punctuate the action, because sometimes he'll mention someone screaming but then not necessarily include a scream. Or, as you mentioned, I believe earlier, dropping the teacup, and therefore he adds the sound of the teacup breaking. In this particular case, the noises that are important are the ways that the actors choose to read the words of the various characters in this. And for those of you that have listened to the audio drama, Amanda's current situation is punctuated in how dreamy she is speaking. And, of course, part of that is the laudanum, and, of course, part of that is the infection. But there is something about that in there that I feel like lends itself to the afterlife aspect to it, that to her there is a dream quality, or a maybe a limbo quality to the way things are proceeding.
I think that there's definitely a lot of that particular chapter's title is, I think, comes to a head in the scene in the bedroom and what Amanda kind of elicits and the ideas she injects in Rebecca's mind, because she brings up how Rafe will be welcomed by their mother and father, who are there waiting for him in the afterlife. And I think that that subject matter is something that Rebecca finds a bit uncomfortable at first. Kind of, both the narration that would be written down in the final text of the novel and mentions that as she says something to comfort Amanda, her voice breaks towards the end. And also in the audio, Sharon's performance as she reads that, I think, sort of captures that really well, where she starts out with the best of intentions of appearing as if she's sort of supportive and comforting, but is actually, I think, towards the end, her internal state of mind kind of betrays her a bit. So I think it combines there. And what Amanda, to kind of weave back to what you were focusing on with how she's kind of tapping into things, I think that the more she sort of talks about things from a world that's beyond Rebecca's comprehension and even just what she's able to fathom, I think the more she feels like she's veering away from what is present and what is here and is starting to become associated with this sort of ethereal other world. And as she sings to herself, you start to hear these echoes of a voice, which I shan't sort of elaborate too much on because that will become important later on in the story.
Father will have just arrived, and Mother will have flowers in her hair, like she did on the day they married.
Somebody spoke her name. It was a voice she had not heard in years. Rebecca glanced at Amanda, but her sister had not spoken these words and was softly singing to herself.
A soldier, soldier, won't you marry me?
It was coming from beyond the bedroom. Immediately, Rebecca was alert and ready to run.
With your musket, fife, and drum. No, sweet maid, I cannot marry thee.
Help.
For I have no shirt to put on.
It's framed to be a ghost that is haunting Rebecca specifically. Then when she comes back down from her singing and brings back her mother and father again, Rebecca kind of snaps at her and says, well, I don't want our father to be there because everything that he represents and in their lives, it just feels like that this everything that Amanda, the picture she's painting, far from being a comfort, is actually kind of repugnant to Rebecca.
No, actually, that's a really good point, is that the afterlife literally comes up as being part of the story. And as you say, the very discussion of it is bringing back those ghosts that Rebecca refers to at the beginning of the story. And she's remembering all too clearly the difficulties that she has had in life. And the stress is just the place they're in and the stress that they're going through. And the conversation, as you say, that Amanda chooses to focus on is just making everything worse. And yeah, that's also important to lead into. So well done there.
Thank you.
Let's see. Of the other things that I wanted to talk about, one of the things that never gets resolved and is a very curious turn is the end of chapter 6, as Rebecca is attempting to get Amanda to rest after dressing her wound and giving her painkilling laudanum. You know, she's just being very solicitous and trying to calm Amanda down, saying, look, Rafe's here. I wouldn't trust anybody else to protect us. And there is a confusing moment where Amanda is telling Rebecca to get out, and there is no explanation for why that is happening. I highlight this because this is one of the unusual mysteries that continue to make things more complicated and will eventually lead some more into the conversations about what makes for gothic genre and setting and all that sort of thing. But do you have insight just from the text alone what Amanda is responding to there, and if Rebecca understands what Amanda is responding to there?
Now, I do have a theory, but it does tie into something that's quite a significant spoiler for later on. So I'm going to drop this as a little thread that we will return to in a later episode. But or I might later on will be a private conversation between Greg and myself, and it can be edited out or anything to that. Don't worry, dear listener, this will be a thread I return to. As far as these chapters and like treating it as a sort of first time reading, I think getting back to your question about whether Rebecca understands exactly what Manda is reacting so intently to, I don't think she really knows or she fully understands. She may have some subconscious inkling, but I think that it is very much, it's treated as a very startling moment where she, and I think the point of this and the performances of the two voice actresses as well do a great job at making it feel like it's come out of from nowhere, because and I think there's a point in the narration where Rebecca kind of carries on as normal, as though Amanda's words matched her tone. And I think that's meant to kind of indicate the words she said really did not match the tone of the scene all the way up to that point. As far as what's going on here, I believe there is something hidden that Amanda maybe sort of deep down feels a bit resentful towards Rebecca about, but it's something which she doesn't act on in normal circumstances, but because of the stresses of being attacked and the what seems to be going on with this infection, I think it's a flash of, I think everyone has that little feeling where they don't really feel as negatively or intensely as they may appear in these moments, but sometimes a little flash of it will just burst out, and it will take both you and the anyone around you completely by surprise when it happens. And I think that that's another element of how the story is kind of the disintegration of the old world, and it's the, it represents that feeling of the old politeness kind of falling away, where everything that you were kind of keeping buried deep down before everything went to pot, when civilities don't matter so much anymore, little flashes will start to come up, and they will be in a lot of ways more alarming than the physical dangers around. So yes, that's what I would say about it, at least for the time being.
Yeah, no, that's actually the concept of civility being very important to people, particularly, it's actually something that gets brought up not only here, but much, much later in another story about the importance of that British stiff upper lip and everything like that. And therefore, on some level, her sudden expletive, not expletive, because that would imply a swear, but her sudden outburst is indicative of not being able to keep everything deep down inside and not letting it out. When I first read it, I almost thought that this might have been the first indication of the infection starting to take hold of Amanda, in that she is losing control or self-possession, or it's just a flash of anger or animal instinct or whatever. But it's something that came up during my reread of it that I had forgotten if there was a greater significance to, and so therefore I put it down on my list as something to discuss, and discuss it later we shall. Of the remaining topics that I wanted to discuss, but also on the same level of hinting that there is more going on here below the surface, the interaction between Rebecca and Rafe during the events of Chapter 7 also merit a little bit of looking into it, because previous to this, there were suggestions in the way that Rafe felt free to talk to her at the end of Chapter 5, but the overall impression that one would seem to have had beforehand is that the two of them didn't necessarily have much of a relationship at all, other than the fact that Rafe was married to her sister. And the way the two of them are speaking now, on some level, could very well just be Rebecca attempting to hash things out with the most reasonable person in the room. I'm feeling this way about something. Are you sure that this is the right course of action? And, you know, just trying to take the temperature. But it certainly feels like there is more of a relationship between the two of them than we have seen thus far.
Picking up on that, I think when Rafe is leaving Amanda's room and Rebecca is coming up to give her laudanum, he mentions, oh, you should make sure that you have, and Rebecca almost like finishes a sentence like, honey, and she shows that she already brought it. Yeah. And Rafe pointedly says, I forgot who I was talking to. And
yes.
So that very much, I think, establishes that we haven't seen this yet, but Rebecca and Rafe aren't casual acquaintances, that there is a history of some sort there.
Yeah. And it would also appear to be not a hostile history, which is some of their original interactions may have suggested, because those first couple of conversations, Rebecca was very much more talking to Amanda than she was Rafe. One of the things that I should let readers know, if they don't already know, Alex loves the nonlinear story. So he will constantly go back and fill in important details in the pasts of various protagonists and such like in order to give you greater context of whatever's going on. And it may not always seem like, why is he doing this now as opposed to some other time, but he's talented at either incorporating the right transition framework in the text or at having the last moment in the present narrative be a reflection of whatever past narrative he now wants to introduce. And he's very good at building a compelling narrative without feeling too jarring or anything like that. Some flashback transitions can be complicated, but Alex always does his best to integrate them very well. And we're going to see more of that, not just in these books, but in this very story as well. And that's all I'll say on the matter. One more thing I wanted to talk about before we ended for this episode is, again, this is us working with all the variations of the story here in this particular case. I understand if there are fans of the series that just do better with the written word than they do with audiobooks or audio dramas and stuff like that, but there is a lot of extra meat that comes into play if you choose to listen to the audio drama. And one of those is the ability to introduce not just compelling background soundtrack and everything like that, but the use of diegetic sound. Because in Chapter 9, there is an amazing moment where, during their quiet conversation, they literally went into the other room ostensibly just to make tea. They also want to talk out of Dawson's hearing and away from his dangerous tirades, so making tea is just an excuse. When they are having their conversation, the score is playing this gentle, bittersweet music that frames the emotional beats of their topic. And then there is a sudden jarring snap, punctuated by the teacup breaking, and the music rises into this tone of dread as Rebecca is reacting to the sudden appearance of Cavendish, the bar guest at the window, the whistling of the tea kettle, which is normally a familiar and almost comforting sound, becomes a way that the tension of the situation is ratcheted up. And even as the characters themselves are specifically using the sound of the tea kettle to keep Cavendish's attention, and therefore are creating this increasingly tense moment for the listener. And when we and Rebecca find out that the action has transitioned to outside, and the tea kettle is no longer part of the scene, the background music itself rises to replace that same sound.
The kettle began to whistle again, low now, as there was less water inside.
Keep it round the back for a moment,
Cleo said firmly, and hobbled out of the kitchen. Rebecca snatched up the poker from the table and gave a sharp rap upon the sink. The smear, faintly illuminated by the oil lamp within the kitchen itself, moved closer. Rebecca rapped on the sink twice more, and it was there at the window again. The speed with which it had crossed the space had been the most frightening aspect. How could they hope to outmaneuver this thing? Rebecca let her focus go slack, and she glanced in its vague direction, aware of its frame behind the glass, but never looking directly. Then she heard the front door open. So did the watcher at the window.
Oh no.
She rushed back into the living room, only to see Aunt Cleo walking out into the moonlit night. It was a limping stride, favouring her left leg, but one of determination. Her cane stood propped by the stairs. She made her way the 100 yards across the lawn, straight for the partially illuminated body of Rafe. Rebecca turned back to the kitchen window. The smear was gone.
It's exceptionally good at keeping emotions high for the listener. And I love it. I think Alex does an excellent job with this sort of thing.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's a... You lose track of the number of times the audio editing element of this adaptation of the core text that the novel represents. I think that there's so many moments where you think, oh, that just one of the all-time best moments in the series. And this is definitely up there and one of them. And I'm so glad you picked up on the idea that the kettle is this, usually this very familiar sound. And I, because that's exactly where my mind headed, because it encapsulates what you talked about earlier about how this episode is called A Quiet Moment. Everything about this episode and how it's framed and how the audio editing makes this so comforting is meant to make this a safe haven. It's the equivalent of the typewriter rooms in a Resident Evil game and the sort of calming music you hear there. But when the teacup shatters, that's the shattering of the feeling of safety here. And when the kettle, it just intensifies the tension, and it's unbearable, but it's fantastic at the same time. And what the distorted kettle sounds like to me by the end of it is like nails on a chalkboard. It is just it becomes unbearable as unbearable events happen in front of you.
Yeah. And to be perfectly honest, way back when I first listened to the story, I didn't even necessarily notice. Good soundtrack, good diegetic sound, it contributes to the overall feeling of a situation without being too intrusive. It's only because when I was going back there and I was trying to dig in deep and paying attention to, you know, every single part of this that I realized how it was contributing and what it was doing to highlight or divide one part of the chapter from the other part of the chapter in terms of the flavor of what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And one small part of this episode, which I noticed on re-listens, is that I don't think it's referred to in the base text at all. So I think this is an example of maybe after Alex writes everything for which Let Them Go is the first... The book was written first and then it was adapted into an audio drama afterwards, whereas a lot of the stories before this point had been each chapter was written as each episode of the podcast was coming out. But with this, I imagine that he wrote this and then when it came to adapting this chapter into an episode of an audio drama, he thought, wait, why don't I add in a sound of Dawson coughing in the other room, just to kind of remind you that, and it sounds distant, so just to remind you that he's there. At the same time, it occurred to me that I'm pretty sure it is Dawson, but it also could potentially be, just as Rebecca heard this ghost of the past, of the voice in the other room in the previous chapter, that cough could be a ghostly sort of echo of Timothy's cough from the past. I don't know if that's intentional, and frankly, that doesn't really matter. It just has the potential to be interpreted in that way. And so for that reason alone, I think it's a great addition where it makes you feel like you're in that place, that there's just that little extra environmental detail there, but it also adds subconsciously to the potential ghosts of the past.
That's actually a really good catch. I don't think I even remember that there was a cough at that moment, but since the discussion of Timothy and who should or shouldn't take blame for what happened is a very important topic of that chapter, it wouldn't surprise me at all if that was meant to be reflective of Timothy, because the coughing, it's a diegetic sound that I believe was used back in chapter 2, and there's going to be more coughing to come. But for now, I think we'll leave it there. One of the things I wanted to eventually discuss was the significance of where Rebecca now finds herself. Cleo is gone. Amanda is not completely there anymore. Rafe is gone. Now she's just left with this unstable man. And what does this mean for the events that are going to play out? But I feel like that will be better addressed once other people have read some of those events and gotten a sense for just how much more dramatic and difficult things were going to proceed. One of the things that I did want to end on is that in the case of other stories that I have read or other movies that I have seen that incorporate horror elements, the things that have proceeded in this particular case are almost, it's not quite textbook or anything like that, but in terms of losing stable influences, losing Rafe to the bar guest is on some level akin to, say, losing Sarge in Aliens, or, you know, other circumstances where people that are meant to be grounding influences being suddenly and violently taken from it and making, therefore, everybody else that's left less stable, or the gradual increase into the uncanny that comes with Amanda biting Dawson and the sudden shock of Cleo striding out into the open, bringing down one monster but being felled by two. All of these are elements that I feel are very triggering, at the very least, to other movies that I have seen. The one that I wanted to bring up in particular, and I actually rewatched this movie in preparation for talking about this, was a movie that came out in 2000 with Vin Diesel called Pitch Black. Did you ever see that movie?
I think I've seen a good chunk of it, but it was one of those ones which is on TV, and I, for one reason or another, not sure I saw it all the way through. Mm-hmm. But I remember the tone of it. So please, carry on.
Well, there are a bunch of elements in there that I was remembering on an emotional level without remembering the specifics. That's part of the reason I'd only seen it like maybe once or twice. That's why I rewatched it, in order to try and remember salient details and everything. But when Cleo dies, back when I was first listening to the audio drama, I brought up to Alex after the fact that her death scene felt very much like the death scene of the protagonist, Fry, in Pitch Black, because she went out there doing the right thing and succeeding at what she set out to do, but at the cost of her own life. And that's part of the reason why it just felt so traumatic when it happened. Again, to see someone going out and doing the right thing and being punished for doing the right thing, in some level, it kills us even more than anything else has ever happened, because Cleo isn't just the crone or the last remaining stabilizing influence because of her position and status. She was setting herself up to be Rebecca's greatest ally in whatever was going forward, and was only seeming to punctuate that even in her current state, she had strength beyond measure, and none of that mattered. She could still be brought down by a tragedy or an accident. So, yeah.
Completely. And to pick up on you saying that she has strength beyond measure, it's surprising when you think about it that she had the strength to be able to fling the shotgun over to Rebecca, and obviously it's the last thing she ever did, so she put everything into it. You're absolutely right, it does carry that same emotional impact, and it feels like I'm still not over it, by the way. I'm still, I think when I was writing up my chapter sort of summary and it was all fresh, I was expressing And, you know, don't get me wrong, it's a really effective and brilliant move from a storytelling perspective. But on the other hand, damn you, Alex, I really hate that this had to happen. But the you made the comparison to Pitch Black and how this chapter progresses. What it reminded me of is another story and a particular character from that, which is Sirius Black in Harry Potter.
Oh,
and
okay.
How specifically in The Prisoner of Azkaban, he has this conversation with Harry about how once he's free, maybe Harry could come to live with him. He could move away from the Dursleys and he could live with someone who knew his parents. And then in the fifth book, Order of the Phoenix, everything is kind of being set up where this is becoming more of a reality and he takes on their parental role. So it's an indication of what future may lay ahead for our protagonist. And it's a beautiful one and everything in you is hoping for it to happen. And then events conspire where both stories present it as something that almost feels like a random act of cruelty that didn't have to happen. That future and that person is snatched away. And in fact, Cleo even has a conversation about family members and things like that. They're a connection to the past, but not in a sort of traumatic way, but in a way where she represents a path towards healing, towards being able to actually move forward. And just like with Harry losing Sirius, I think when Rebecca loses Cleo, that is at that point all hope that they can go back to the old world, and not only do that but do it in a way where things will be better than they were before, or at least that there is a bright future ahead. All of that is kind of snatched away.
So you say all of that, and all of a sudden, all I can think of is that one moment in John Wick, where it's like, you killed that from me!
I had that written down! Greg, this is my apartment.
I mean, obviously, Rebecca doesn't quite go off on that kind of a tangent, because she's not that kind of a person, but yeah, no, that's... we're honing in on some of the same... story elements and moments in cinematic experience. I don't have any experience at all with Harry Potter, so well done with that. That's not something I would have ever been able to pull out of my hat. But yeah, no, that's...
I apologize for going into confusing detail and maybe giving away a spoiler on that.
No, it's perfectly okay. I don't know how deeply I'm going to jump into Harry Potter at this point, but it's probably provide additional context and being like, oh yeah, that's kind of like for those of you listeners out there who are Harry Potter fans. So
it's a very niche franchise. I doubt there's many people out there.
You keep doing that. No,
I have no idea what you're talking about.
All right, I feel like that brings us to the end of this episode for now. On our next episode, normally my initial instinct was to try and divide the reviews of the books up into four chapters apiece. In this particular case, as has been previously mentioned, it worked better to do five chapters because that encapsulated part one of Let Them Go. And the next episode, basically, it not only brings us to a very specific storytelling break that I don't necessarily want to cut in half, but it's also the last three chapters are the last three chapters of part two. And then when we do the final episode after that, the final five chapters of Let Them Go will be part three of that book. So I think there'll be plenty to discuss for next time, even though we're doing fewer chapters. Yeah. But obviously, this is still a beginning for us. And some episodes may be longer than others. We're going to try and hit all of the marks and give you all of the deep dives that we can on what's going on. But we hope you've enjoyed this episode. So, I've been Greg.
I've been Toby.
We'll see you around the multiverse.